Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across Northern British Columbia. Our podcast is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program that the Specialist Services Committee, which is a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation from local health authorities. We are casting to you today from the traditional territory of the Kleidlay-Tenay First Nation. And hosting today's episode are Dr. Sheer Chewy and myself, Deanna Danskin.
You're listening to QualityCast North. I'm Sheer Chewy.
I'm Deanna Danskin.
Northern British Columbia comprises a vast geographical area the size of France. It is extremely sparsely populated. Road links and municipal infrastructure to many of the smaller communities is limited, and the harsh Canadian winters compound challenges to living during 6 months of the year. These challenges may seem intractable when it comes to providing healthcare, but rural physicians have responded with innovative solutions using modern technology in their pursuit of healthcare equity. One of these physicians is our guest today, Dr. John Palevich, who's joined by Sandy Lee. And their latest innovation is using drone technology to improve health in rural northern BC. Hi, John and Sandy. Thank you for joining us today. Now, before we go on and talk about the drones, I wonder whether, John, you can give us a little background about yourself. Maybe just a little talk about maybe your earlier years. Where did you grow up and what influenced you to pursue a career in medicine?
Sure. So I grew up, actually I was born in northern Alberta in a northern agricultural community known as Spirit River, Alberta. It's kind of a dot on the map, very inconspicuous place. My father happened to be a longtime rural physician there, one of two physicians. And so that's where I was born. But I really grew up down in the Lower Mainland in the Central Fraser Valley in the Abbotsford area in the Stolo traditional territory. And throughout my youth, I had the good fortune to be exposed to both my family farming roots back in Saskatchewan, which is obviously rural, but also to different areas in rural BC that I really developed a strong affinity for a love of the outdoors. And then when I entered school, my schooling years and post-secondary years and then to university, continued to obviously develop more of an interest in rural. And when I graduated from medical school from the University of British Columbia in 1994, started my journey in family medicine out in Chilliwack, but really with a focus to learn more about how to be a rural physician. And so to that end, I remember sitting down with my program director of the day, a chap named Mark Longhurst, who's now deceased, and really kind of helping Mark understand what my hope was to practice in the hinterland of British Columbia. And so I thought I really needed to do some time, so to speak, in rural community in my residency training. So I spent half my residency training in Quesnel. And so really my connection with Northern British Columbia started back in my residency years in 94 and 90 to 96, where I spent a lot of time in Quesnel working there in the Avery Clinic. With icons such as John Haven and John Fine and others. It's a great place to learn as a resident. And then I met my wife in my residency training, Sarah. She's a family doc as well. And off we went. And our first home was in Quesnel, where we started to work there as family physicians and really rural generalists. During my time there, Dr. Jerry McFetridge, who's a longtime Northern BC doc, introduced me to First Nations Health. And we used to do clinics out west in Nazco and Kluskas area. That really kind of was my first authentic introduction to First Nations healthcare. And that kind of grew. And as I continued to move forward in my career, in 1999, Sarah and I moved to Fraser Lake, where we stayed for 12 years until 2011 and developed a really robust primary care clinic there with a great team over many years and worked closely with the Carrier Nation there, specifically the Stalatin First Nation and not the First Nation. So that's where kind of my journey took me. And during that time, one thing to note is since my residency time, the communities I've worked in have continued to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And with that smallness comes challenges with access to healthcare, both personnel, but also resources and medicines and imaging and just every aspect of healthcare that you can imagine, going to appointments, getting your tests done, whatever it happens to be. It's just a harder hill to climb for people in rural, remote, and First Nations communities. And over the years, I just developed a real interest in trying to understand that, but then what could I do to contribute to improving the health and wellness of people living in these communities?
That's great. That's a great origin story, actually. So you've really been rural pretty much all your career. That's wonderful. And Sandy, can I ask you a little bit about your journey to where you are currently? What did your journey look like and where are you now?
Well, I grew up in Vancouver. My family's a first generation immigrant to Canada. And I kind of went into healthcare because my dad was actually put on a clinical trial that saved his life. And it really impacted me to really want to pursue work related to healthcare. And so I initially went into research and found my way into a public policy master's degree, and then later on has been previously working with First Nations Health Authority for 4 or so years before moving into this UBC role. So I've been working with John for the last 2.5 years in the Slan First Nation region, and have been really enjoying the First Nations and technology integration work that we've been doing here.
Excellent. You touched a little bit on this, John, but I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about the rural communities that you serve, and particularly the ones you serve in this project. Where are they, and what is it actually like to live there?
So I'll just talk about the communities that have been involved in our first phase of our project, the DTI, and then try to help people understand that we're now in a transition phase as we prepare and set ourselves up for the second phase. But the first phase of our project took place in the belly of BC, if you will, right in the heart of the province, in the traditional territory of the Stalaton and Notley First Nations, where on the edge of Fraser Lake, if people know where Fraser Lake is, about an hour and 45 minutes, about 160 kilometers to the west of Prince George. The lake itself is about 20 kilometers. The Stalaton community of Stalaton, the First Nation, sits on the western edge of Fraser Lake. And then on the southern edge, a little to the east, is the community of Fraser Lake. So the communities are not that greatly separated from a geography standpoint. And that was part of the reason why we chose those two communities to participate in our drone project. We weren't too interested in the drone going too far, but we wanted to learn about what needed to be considered in the respective communities about hosting a drone, that is, having a drone land, take off in your community, what kind of things need to be considered for personnel, infrastructure, and so forth. So that's where we started. Again, right in the heart of British Columbia, in those traditional territories.
Mm-hmm. And what is it actually like to live in these communities? And what are the challenges that the people there face?
Sure. So there's no hospital in Fraser Lake. They used to be called diagnostic and treatment centers, but community health centers may be another name that people are familiar with. In the First Nations community in Stalaton, they also have a health center. There are no inpatient beds in either of these communities. There's a small emergency room in Fraser Lake. There are no specialists. There is no blood. There is sometimes access to things like a basic X-ray and sometimes access to basic laboratory exams. After hours, emergency services transition over to Vanderhoof, which is 45 minutes down the Highway 16 to the east. And so there's now a single pharmacy also in Fraser Lake that is available Monday to Friday, kind of 9 to 5-ish. So anything after hours or on the weekend, there's no access to pharmaceutical medications. There's a school which both Slatin and Notley First Nation feed into as well, but it's now centralized in Fraser Lake. There used to be a bank. There's no longer a bank. There used to be a mine that was active in the area. There's no longer a mine. West Fraser has a mill there that continuously to slim its shifts down that we see, and that's a common story in rural British Columbia. So it's a resource-based community of Fraser Lake, and the Stellaton community and the Notley community participate in activities in forestry, mining, and that kind of thing, as well as fisheries, things like that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm going to hand off to Deanna now, who's I think is going to ask you a little bit about the project itself and some of the key aspects about that.
Yeah, so we've set the stage of what these communities are like and just how rural it is and the limitation of services. So I want to talk a little bit more about the drone project and what you were doing with drones to improve rural healthcare. So I guess just going back to the beginning, where did this idea to implement the use of drones originally come from?
Thanks so much, Deanna. The simple answer is it fit into kind of the quest to improve the health and wellness of community members living in these remote communities. And the Drone Transport Initiative, the DTI, as it's known, was spawned in the time of COVID. And it was spawned during a time when access to healthcare resources became amplified and illuminated. So communities like Stellaton, you'll remember back in the spring of 2020, we all kind of became frozen in our own, wherever we were, in our homes. If we were traveling overseas, we were stuck there, where we were. And First Nations communities were affected in a great way in that not knowing the vulnerabilities of what was about to descend on us, they became locked down. And so people couldn't go in, couldn't go out, resources couldn't get in, couldn't get out. And then as things moved on in the pandemic, you may remember hearing very simple things like getting a COVID test in rural British Columbia was a heroic act. And it was a laborious act and a drawn out act. And so I could get a COVID swab done in a patient, but I couldn't do anything with the COVID swab. And so if a patient lived in Stellaton or in Takla or one of our far away First Nations communities, the swab had to be transported. And at the beginning of the pandemic, it had to be sent to Vancouver, and a whole bunch of things had to happen. And so this was all just to get a COVID test, okay? And then as the pandemic went on, new things kept creeping into the story, things like Paxlovid. It was the medicine that was going to help treat active COVID infections. And guess what? It was really hard to get Paxlovid to these communities again. And so and then there was the post-COVID clinic that happened. And where was the post-COVID clinics? Where did they happen? They happened in large urban centers, places where rural people don't live. And if you're in a remote community, you can't access these things for various reasons. So the genesis of the DTI was simply to try to understand whether drone technology could positively influence the medical supply chain. In simplistic terms. So we know that most things are moved on the ground on Highway 16 in the context of Fraser Lake and Stellaton. There's a small limited airport there, but really no effective flights go in and out. Doesn't have any lights. We don't send in aircraft to transport material. So really everything comes by the ground. And that has great limitations when Highway 16 is impassable for various reasons, or there are manpower shortages, which we've seen. How can we make a difference in accessing healthcare resources? And we've learned a lot in the last number of years about drones. We're kind of in a better place than we were, say, if we rewound the clock to 2009 when I started personally dabbling in virtual health, like doing a call like this. People thought it was really kind of crazy. Unnecessary, foolish, that kind of thing. I like to think we're more liberated, and COVID was a good teacher maybe we should have been doing this kind of stuff long ago. Maybe we should think about other ways of seeing patients, other ways of delivering healthcare resources, and understanding that drones are used for good and bad things in the world. And we hear about those things in the news. We like any tool, we want to use it for the good. And these communities stand to benefit an amazing amount about accessing medical supplies or helping with laboratory investigations, just to give some clear examples.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And talked about COVID swabs and COVID medication. What other types of supplies are currently going back and forth with these drones?
Just so I want to be really clear. Nothing's going back and forth in the drone at this point. These are things that are mostly aspirational. It's things that when we started our drone project, we actually did not start the project with the intent of transporting anything. The project started with the intention of simply like a feasibility journey with the communities and the drone. And then as we moved on, and Sandy can speak to this, there were many things that had to be overcome for us to actually put us a simple prescription on a drone from Fraser Lake and send it 5 kilometers to Stellantis, but we achieved that. And so really that's the exciting part about where we are today and where we want to go tomorrow about what could we send. And I think I stated earlier, there are things that are not available in Fraser Lake and in emergency services, that is things like blood. So if you're a pregnant mom and you just had a baby and you're bleeding, if you're in a car accident and you have internal injuries and you're bleeding, we traditionally in our province move patients to larger centers to gain access to resources like blood. And what we need to learn is in other jurisdictions in the world, they actually reverse that and bring the resources to where patients are. And so, and really that's what this is all about, whether it's life-saving blood, whether it's medication. I've been in a community further away, like Tackle Landing, and had a patient who was critically ill, who I know I needed to put to sleep so I could put an airway down into their lungs to help them breathe. But I couldn't do it because I didn't have enough medicine to keep them safely paralyzed and asleep. And so I just didn't have enough medicine. I had a small amount, but the help wasn't going to come for like 10 to 12 hours. In fact, it took 14 hours for help to come. You need a lot of medicine to keep somebody asleep for 12 hours. And so low resource settings, if they have any of these kinds of medicines, have a very modest and minimal amount. And so these are just examples of when you're working in low resource settings, the challenges that healthcare providers and community members are confronted with. And so bringing resources to communities, what's possible? How could we in the future send a drone from Prince George with blood in minutes, along with some other life-saving equipment or medicine that we don't have there? That's really where we're ultimately hoping to go.
Very salient points about all the infrastructure that you need to have one of these types of projects, be actually sustainable and successful in the long term. Things around like how it works in the community, safety around the transportation of blood can't freeze if it's going to someone, and lots of challenges. So it's really interesting, to take a step back and make sure you're doing all those steps ahead of time to make sure it's actually getting things safely to the patients potentially in the future. So can you tell me a little bit about the drones themselves? Like, how big are they? Who's driving them? How much could they carry potentially?
I'm going to pass it over to Sandy and give her an opportunity to share because her knowledge about much of the technology, including the drones, but also what they can carry and some of our futuristic plans around what's possible is really interesting and exciting. Sandy, over to you.
Okay. Well, the drones that we used in our first phase, we did 12-month operation across the 4 seasons in Stellaco and Fraser Lake. And so across the 12 months, we completed over 1,200 flights. And The drones that we used were able to fly up to 23 kilometer distance. The material distance that we were flying was across the lake, and it was around 6 or 7 kilometers in flight. The cargo size that we were transporting was about like a shoe size box. Like, so just imagine a shoe size, a shoe box, and then it's about 9 pounds in weight. And so We weren't really transporting anything that was substantively large in size, and largely that was in part because of the regulations that we are faced with at this point by Transport Canada. And so Transport Canada regulates drone operation across Canada. And although drones have been used in healthcare services in many other countries like Rwanda and Mozambique and Ghana, drones are still heavily regulated in North America because of the complexity of the airspace. And so with current Transport Canada regulations, we're only allowed to utilize commercially regulated drones are only allowed to be up to 25 kg in weight. And so this limits the distance they can travel because of what kind of fuel cells we can use, as well as what we can carry within the drones. But with that being said, we are anticipating some regulatory changes in summer of 2024. And so that means that drones that can weigh up to 125 kg in weight can be operationalized. And that might also mean that we can utilize drones that fly much longer ranges, carry larger cargo sizes. It's a bit of a trade-off if you're flying further than you often can't carry as much weight. And so our next phase is working with the drone company and our collaborators with Applied Sciences, with Pharmaceutical Sciences, with also the regulators to find a pathway towards operationalized larger drones, and then also matching that up with the healthcare system.
And so what kind of challenges did you encounter flying the drones? Like, I'm thinking more like, obviously you've discussed some of the regulatory challenges, but what about the actual weather itself? And you're flying over a lake. I don't know. We have forest fires. We have big electrical storms and blizzards. Did that sort of thing impact the work?
Yeah. And I think what's been quite fascinating is because we were able to operationalize the work across four seasons, we were able to learn from the data that we collected throughout either cancellations of the flight or flights that were successful and what kind of conditions were conducive for the drone to operationalize. And so what we've learned was, first of all, we were using an electric drone, and so it was the lithium battery was not very had quite a limitation towards the temperature that we can operate in. And so for like Fraser Lake, which is in central northern interior of BC, it is like there were quite a few. I would say like most from January, February. Good portion of those months we were not able to operate because of the freezing conditions and because like the temperature was too low for the lithium battery to operate. Surprisingly, the reverse can also happen. And so what we also learned was there were shoulder months where because we're operating out of a lake, there are these wind tunnels that get formed, and the wind tunnels affect the drone operation. And then in the summer months, because of the storage of the drone have resulted in some cancellations because of the overheating of the drone. And so there are quite a number of like kind of small components of drone operation that we were learning from this work. And thankfully we have a group of quantitative analysts on our team that supported us with creating a drone modeling. And so now we can use a developed model to estimate what is the likelihood of successful drone operation if we were to change up the technology, if we were to change up the location. And so that type of modeling work is anticipated to be used in the next phase as well.
Yeah, that's cool. I seem to recall there's a lot of swans around Fraser Lake. You didn't hit any swans. They weren't getting in your way.
No, and that was actually one of our major questions that we received from community members, because on the Fraser Lake side, the drone site that we were operating was right off the park called White Swan Park, and so it's known for all of the swans and birds and ospreys that kind of fly throughout the seasons. And so community members during our community engagement had really raised the concerns around how it would affect the wildlife in the area. And to our surprise, there were occasions where birds have flown very close to the drone, and I think they just wanted to check out what this very large flying thing is in the air. And in no occasion were there any interference with the birds or had affected any of the birds. And so having our drone operate for 5 days a week, 14 to 16 times a day, like that was quite promising to know that there was no impact.
Oh, very cool. So it sounds like, yeah, you have lots of opportunities to build on the success and the learning so far. So yeah, very, very interesting. I think I'm going to pass it back to you, Cher, if you want to continue.
Thank you, Deanna. I'm just going to change tack a little bit now. And so I happen to know, John, this is just one of the many projects that you've actually helped set up, right, to improve rural healthcare quality. And you also have a leadership role with the Rural Coordination Center of BC, I'm aware, helping rural doctors across the province support each other and collaborate to improve the services that they provide. And so with all of this on your plate, can I ask you, and also Zandi as well, because I'm pretty sure anyone who's involved in this sort of business, you know, is they have to be very protective of their spare time, but how do you both take care of yourself and keep yourself from burning out? I'm going to ask you, John, first, if that's all right.
I'm probably the wrong person to ask, but I have a really good wife. Let me just start with that safe comment. And that, again, our partners are so, and our families are so pivotal in the longitudinal success of the immediate, but also more importantly, the longitudinal success of our work. And I guess what drives me is the passion and the love for doing what I do. So, you know, if you love what you do, it's not really work. And that sounds very cliche, but it's just the people we work with are so exceptional. The reasons we do this are so necessary. The opportunities to transform healthcare are truly achievable. And I just see COVID has seen the greatest advancement of the use of technology, arguably, in how healthcare providers communicate and collaborate. And it's arguably been the greatest time in our recent history where we can make such an impact for communities that have historically been super challenged and under-prioritized by the healthcare system in accessing healthcare resources. So that's all to say that there are a lot of balls in the air. It's often not easy. You do have to take time out, and thankfully, this holiday season, I'm going to get a few days with my family and some alone time, which will be really, really nice. But there are so many rewards here, Shir, that that I guess keep fueling the next, helping us turn the next page, and getting up in the morning and, you know, and rubbing my hands together and say, okay, what do we got to do today? And I have to say, with our DTI work, the brilliance of Sandy and being our project manager and not blowing smoke in any way, that's what allows a project like this to work concurrently with a project like RTVS or doing POCUS work for rural communities. It's the amazing people we work with in this province to do this work. And together, of course, we're much greater than the sum of our parts, and it allows us to push past historical obstacles where we are burning out in fatigue and frustration and all those negative things. So that probably doesn't answer your question very well, but I guess that's the best I got today. So
I know that's pretty good, John, actually. And what about you, Sandy? What do you do to keep yourself well and healthy and prevent yourself from burning out? Do you have any strategies?
Yeah, well, I definitely have my fair share of sports after work. It forces me to leave work and do something outside of that. And I have a little puppy right now. It's running around in my background. Hopefully you're not hearing him. But I think what John had mentioned, like the people really make a huge difference. And I'm so happy to have been working with John and other project sponsors who are just so motivated to do this work. And bring in all these very interesting people that are also very interested in the work.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful to hear, actually. And so I think we're actually at the end of our interview now, and time's run out. And so it's been wonderful. to have you both on and to hear about your fantastic drone project. And I wish you all the best in the next phase, which is going to be a really exciting time for that. But I can hear the closing music, which means that sadly we have to bring this interview to a close. So thank you again for both of you for joining us today, John and Sandy. And as a token of our thanks, as always, we like to send you an exclusive and highly coveted Quality Cast coffee mug as a token of our thanks, and that'll be winging its way to you shortly. Now, if you, the listener, would like to know more about today's topic and our guests, you can find more details with our show notes on our website, which is nhpqi.ca/podcast. And you can also find there links to our prior episodes. If you enjoyed listening to today's episode, you can subscribe to our channel on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you again for joining us today. I'm Cher Chewy.
I'm Deanna Danskin.
And you've been listening to Quality Cast North. Today's episode was hosted and co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Deanna Danskin, with technical support from Matt Walker. Original music by Daniel Chewy and artistic support by Reggie Goodine. Further information on the content of today's episode is available with the show notes on our website, nhpqi.ca. Quality Cast North is recorded on the traditional territory of the Clayclaytonay First Nation. If you enjoyed today's interview, check out our other episodes available on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you find your podcasts.